You ain't got no job. And you got shit to do. So that's why you got to listen to Inside the Crazy Ant Farm. Oh my goodness. I am super excited to be back. And this one is going to be special because we're going to be talking all about the DCU and what is happening with all of these rumors going around, like what actor's staying, what actor's going. The new Blue Beetle movie just hit the theaters a couple weeks ago, so we're going to be talking all about that and going to be giving some of our opinions as well.
Of course. And we'll try to figure out who's telling the truth, Gail Gadot or James Gunn. We don't know, but we're going to give some opinions on it for sure.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, how could we not? How could we not? But it's going to be a great freaking show. So let's get a little crazy. What's up, guys? Welcome back to episode 232 of
yes.
Inside the Crazy Ant Farm. Holy moly, you guys know your host with the most, myself, J-Lo Fantastic, and the one and only Mal.
What's up?
Guys, you guys know you can follow us anywhere and everywhere on social media at JLoganAustin and at CrazyAntCEO to stay up to date with all of our thoughts and opinions in between shows. But man, oh man, we're super excited to be back. So, before teasing the rest of the show, be sure to leave a rating on this podcast, comment below, and tell us what you actually think about the show, because leaving a rating actually helps the podcast get seen by more people who enjoy the entertainment news, plus those who are trying to break into the entertainment industry. But man, oh man, of course, the strikes are still going on, so we're going to be filling you all in with the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strikes, because there's been so much stuff happening in the past couple weeks that you're like, oh, is it almost over? Wait, no, it's not. Like, it's kind of crazy. So we're going to fill you in on all in on that. And then, like we said in the teaser, we're going to be talking all about the DCU.
Yes.
Man, oh man, do we think the Blue Beetle movie was the right start to kick off this new quote-unquote franchise, or at least under the new regime, as we should say? But I'm super excited about it because we have some strong opinions about the Blue Beetle movie and about all of these different rumors that are going out in Hollywood and that are leaving a lot of people hanging. I'm not even gonna lie, because there's a lot of he shed, she shed. She sells, she shelled by the
tea. Is that on Paradise Island? Is that where they're selling those shells?
Exactly. But before we get this thing started, be sure to head over to our website, www.crazyantmedia.com. We're going to start rocking the latest and greatest Crazy Ant Media gear. We got shirts, we got hats, we got tumblers, we got the special buttons, we got phone cases, we have tumblers, we have anything and everything you need for your merchandise needs, man. It's so super exciting. We appreciate everybody who has bought some Crazy Ant merch. Y'all are absolutely amazing, and you look phenomenal in it.
Yes.
Say that enough.
Cannot look any better.
Exactly. But of course, like we said, we want to give you an update on the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strikes. So this past week, SAG-AFTRA issued a statement to encourage members to promote and audition for approved interim agreement productions as a means of strengthening the union's bargaining positions and demonstrating solidarity. The guild statement provides guidance in regards to the matter of promoting a project with an interim agreement, which has been a matter of contention among the SAG-AFTRA members since the strike began back in July. Now, stars such as Sarah Silverman and Viola Davis have publicly questioned whether SAG-AFTRA members work under those circumstances would even be appropriate in this matter. Now, for projects to obtain an interim agreement for the guild, a producer must operate independently from the companies belonging to the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers and agree to the terms proposed by SAG-AFTRA in its negotiations with the AMPTP. Now, the release comes as the film industry prepares for the fall festival season, with events in Venice, Trelide, and Toronto kicking off over the next few weeks. Now, film festivals represent major launching pads for projects seeking distribution or looking to make a splash in the awards race. The matter of SAG-AFTRA members being allowed to promote in Toronto, Telluride, and Venice has a major question mark since the strike has begun, and the guild's new statement represents a push that would leave some level of talent being on the grounds at festivals. provided that their productions have been obtained by those interim agreements that we've been talking about.
So this is tricky for me because, first of all, I think this move, I don't buy, like at the top of the statement saying that it was for solidarity to show strength in their negotiating abilities or whatever. I think this is because they've got festivals coming up and they want stars on the red carpet because those festivals won't do anything without the stars there. So that's what I really think it's about. But then I'm also, how is this going to go down? Because we know, no doubt, at these festivals, there's probably a bunch of independent films that have SAG actors in them that are looking for distribution deals, right? That's where you normally get the deals from the studios. That's where they go into bidding wars and buy these films and everything. What I'm confused about, though, is how many of those are actually not associated already because they wouldn't have had interim agreements when these films were made, right? Because there wasn't a strike going on. So they're saying they have to be a part of this interim agreement thing, but these films were shot prior to that. So is that a little hiccup? Is that like, how do you get around the stars promoting something that isn't under the interim agreement? And I mean, I just, it's all kinds of shady to me. I just think it's like, hey, we are on strike, but we want you to go out there and do this. And we kind of want you to, you know, you're either on strike or you're not, right? And if the studios are not in a contract deal with anybody, right, then how are they going to buy these movies? How are they bidding on these movies, right? You're going to bid on a movie that your stars can't promote? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. I feel like this was just a rushed decision, right? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, and so it's been very interesting because I feel like they are getting a lot of blowback now from actors who, you know, have been speaking out for SAG-AFTRA ever since the strike has begun. Yeah. And I feel like now, like, with it being so back and forth with not only the writers and the actors, it's just become one of these things where like, okay, are you guys actually fighting for us or are you dragging this out longer than it needs to be? So that's the real question in my eyes to see, you know, where are bargaining chips and how are they being placed? Is like $100 going on red 21 or like, how are we doing this? So I feel like, you know, even a lot of actors are coming out now and they're like, okay, we're ready for this to be over so we can get back to work and start promoting things. So it's a very interesting thing, man. It's definitely something that it develops every single week. So that's why we have to keep talking about it. But yeah, I just, you know, they keep saying there's light at the end of the tunnel, but every time they say that, a couple days later, that light goes further and further away.
Oh, so without doubt.
That's the thing I'm reckoning with in my brain.
Without doubt. And what you just said, the maybe the tiniest of little factions within SAG-AFTRA, the studios are paying attention to that, and they're trying to get that with the WGA. So so let me kind of explain what happened this week with the WGA, because remember, SAG-AFTRA can't even be at the table because the WGA is currently at the table back negotiating. So the Writers Guild of America told members this week that the latest offer from the studios is not yet good enough and said that it would continue to fight to address existential threats to the writing profession. So if you guys aren't familiar, and then I'm going to go a little bit further into this, the CEOs, not AMTP, the CEOs, and I'm talking about the big boys, Iger and Sarandos and Zaslav, and they want this shit done. So they basically told the AMPTP, we're getting a little frustrated that you guys cannot get this done. Let's have a meeting. So they had a meeting with the AMPTP representatives. They kind of said, let's make some concessions. Let's show them we're willing to negotiate a little bit. Apparently that happened. They came up with a new proposal and they really felt like this was going to happen. This was going to, like, this would show that they're willing to compromise. So in an email, the WGA picked out half a dozen areas where it believes the studios still fell short. The guild noted that the studios are willing to enshrine the concept of a TV staff size in the contract for the first time ever. But the loopholes, limitations, and omissions in their modest proposal, too numerous to single out, make them effectively toothless, the Guild said. The Guild also said that the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers offered to make streaming viewership data available only to a half dozen WGA staffers. What? Why would you not show it to everybody? Right. The data could then be used by the Guild to craft a proposal for a viewership-based residual in 3 years. Not right away. In 3 years. Again, doesn't make sense. The AMPTP released its proposals shortly after a meeting with several studio CEOs and WGA leadership at the Lux Sunset Boulevard Hotel. Why did they do that? Because, as I just told you, the WGA said no. So they released it, and the WGA thinks they released the proposal to try to cause that friction between members, like they're seeing in SAG-AFTRA. Maybe if they showed that they're willing to do some stuff, that there would be some WGA members that would agree, hey, they're trying, can we get this shit done, we're ready to get back to work. But apparently it backfired because the union came out even more in strength of, you're right, if it's not everything we're asking for, we're not good. So as I said, they did release the proposal shortly after the meeting. And at that meeting, like I said, Bob Iger of Disney, David Zasloff of Warner Brothers, they communicated to the Guild, it's been 115 days, we need to get this done, we're well over it. Now, by releasing the terms of the latest offer, the AMPTP is seeking to put pressure on the Guild leadership by demonstrating both to writers and the broader entertainment community that it is trying to make concessions and that the WGA is the bad guy. I'm not buying it. Like you are, okay, we see that, yeah, but is it really a concession? Because there's stipulations to it. Okay, we'll give you the streaming data in 3 years. We'll guarantee the size of a writer's room, but only two people. There were stipulations attached to all of their concessions. So are they really concessions if that's the case? I feel like this was just a move to try to make themselves look like the good guys and try to put the pressure on both guilds to get this shit done. And apparently it's not. And as you guys have seen, things are being pushed back. Things are being pushed back. And from everything that we know, you guys are pretty familiar with this. The industry basically, Hollywood shuts down after Thanksgiving. They take this big long break before awards season and everything. So if this shit isn't wrapped up within the next couple of weeks going into September, that doesn't leave a very big gap to try to get it done before Hollywood shuts down anyway. So you could start to see things now that were supposed to be coming out, not just this year, but all of next year being pushed back and having to be readjusted. So that's where they're at. And the studios, I know, are freaking the fuck out because they don't want to have no content for a whole year. That is not good news for anybody. So I don't know, man. It's like, but I'm not seeing an end to it because they're just not willing to give everybody what they want. And it seems to me like both the unions are very adamant about everything or nothing.
Yeah, it's very crazy because I feel like you said, it's either all or nothing. And everybody just keeps going back and forth. Like there'll be some optimism and then there won't be. It'll be like completely far to the other side. So it's very interesting to see how this thing keeps developing. Like, because I mean, you know, we have friends in the entertainment industry. With us being in the entertainment industry ourselves, we, you know, we have our ear on the ground and we listen to a lot of people coming out with a lot of different numbers and a lot of different examples of these type of talks, negotiations. And it just, you know, it every other day, I feel like we are getting told different things, whether that be from the media or whether that be from our friends in the industry or what have you. I just feel like, you know, it's hard to try to keep up with everything because it changes so frequently. So that's very terrifying. I for Disney Channel specifically, I saw this report come out about how they would only, for writers, they would get residuals after like three seasons, right?
Yeah.
And then basically, they reboot the show after those three seasons so that the writers weren't guaranteed those residuals. They would bring them back for the new show, but in their contract, it would say you can't get the residuals until after the third season.
Right.
For example, like The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, and then The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody on Deck. So, like, it's technically two different shows.
Yeah.
But they added that new title and rebranded it, so that made it a new show.
Yep.
To where they're bringing back all these same people, but in the writers' contracts, and I'm betting in the actors' contracts as well, things get shifted around to where they don't have to get paid those residuals. So, I mean, new stuff comes out every single day, like I said. So it's fascinating but terrifying at the same time.
I will say, I'm going to give the studios credit on one thing that they proposed, and I think it was a good thing, and I hope that it stays in whenever they come to an agreement. They did say that they were going to institute a program, a training program, for writers to be taught how to become showrunners. So if you're just a staff writer, you're in the room, you happen to be one of those people, they're going to have a program that's going to allow you to go through it and basically graduate and be able to become a showrunner, and not just throwing a blind writer in and say, okay, it was your idea, so you're the showrunner, and they have no clue what they're doing, right? I like that idea. I think anytime that they can implement those type programs, those training programs to get you up to speed, that's a good thing. So I just wanted to give a shout out to that, because that was one good thing in their proposal that I thought made sense. And to what you said about our friends, we have them guys on both sides. So we have friends who are saying, I'm ready to just give in, and I want to get back to work. I'm willing to concede some of these things to get it done. And we have other people on both the writing and the acting side that are like, no way, it's all or nothing. So even in our group of friends, there's those two points of view. And I get it. It's frustrating. And I feel like no matter what side you come down on, it's starting to get frustrating. So, yeah. I don't know, man. Yeah, I guess we'll see.
It's one of those things. Like I said, it changes every single day. But, you know, we're going to stay on top of it and keep bringing you guys the latest news. But it's absolutely wild. Now heading over to DCU. Oh, yes. My goodness. So this, everybody knows that Blue Beetle was the first official film that came out for this DCU
character.
Character.
Yeah.
What was the first official film?
The first official film will be Superman Legacy.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So that means they'll use Blue Beetle in this universe.
Yes. So Gunn said, he clarified it, because a lot of people, and this is what this whole segment's going to be about, is clearing this confusion up. This movie was put into production, and I don't know if a lot of people even remember, but it was supposed to go specifically straight to Max, but then they decided to release it theatrically because I guess they really liked it. And this movie was under Walter Hamada and the old regime, but Gunn and Safran apparently saw it and liked the character. They liked Blue Beetle, so they came out with a statement saying, this guy will be carrying over into our universe. But they clarified that that movie is not the launch to the universe, just this guy will pop up in our universe. So
I see. I mean it did really well, in my opinion, the way it played. Obviously the box office numbers do not show that, but I think DC is going to have to do a lot of crawling their way back up to earning the fans' trust, because so far, I mean, over the past decade, basically, DC fans have been going to see movies and being heavily let down, whether that be with a few aspects or a lot of different aspects. And don't get me wrong, Marvel's not perfect. So, I mean, of course, there's few aspects in their films and maybe some aspects that are disappointing. But I feel like they did really well in this film. I loved it. Like, I had literally no problem with it entirely. I've talked about multiple times before, I'm a big pacing guy, and sometimes DC films have a real trouble with pacing. But this one I felt like was really good. It was fun. It had that family dynamic. It had that love interest. I felt like, you know, to put DCU stamp on this one is something that they should be proud of, because this is something I feel like you could build off of. It kind of had that Ant-Man vibe where it's like, okay, you're not the original Blue Beetle, but we're going to introduce the original Blue Beetle at some point down the line and that type of thing. So I just, you know, I, if they keep heading in that direction and with that type of thing, I think they're going to do really well.
Yeah, totally agree. I think that this film is like a mix between the first Iron Man and Ant-Man, because like you said, it's introducing the second version of the character, but for movie audiences that aren't familiar, it's the first version, right? But they did obviously mention Ted Kord, who is the original Blue Beetle, which also sets up an interesting thing, because as all the comic book fans know, Ted Kord's Blue Beetle and Booster Gold teamed up. They were like a team, and they part of the Justice League. So they're clearly going in that direction. Why even bring Ted Kord back into it, right? Or show anything about Ted if we weren't going to see him at some point, which would clearly hint that we're going to see Booster Gold at some point also. But yeah, I think this film, I think Blue Beetle went back to when Marvel was working, when everything was clicking and rolling with Marvel. It got everything right. It got dramatic storytelling, right? There were deaths. There was a serious death in it. No spoilers, but there was a serious death in it. There was serious undertone to it, but then it was hilarious. There was a lot of comedy to it. There was a ton of action to it. And that, in my opinion, all of phase one, basically all of the first few phases leading up to Endgame and stuff, that's what made it work. You were invested and it had every little aspect. Just when you thought it was getting a little too funny, bam, somebody died and it got all fucking serious, right? And there was some comedic, but then there was action, and they had all of that. And Blue Beetle does that. And I think it capitalized on what used to work for Marvel, and that I think Marvel needs to desperately get back to, is that formula. So I'm excited. I'm excited about Blue Beetle. I think it's the right move by Gunn and Safran to continue to push him into the new universe. Without the E, guys, have you noticed? It's just DCU. No more extended, right? Because people are still confused by that. They're still calling it the DCEU, and it's like, nope, that's over. That was Snyderverse.
Yeah.
The DCEU was the Snyderverse, and that is gone. Now, I can understand why people are confused, because Flash came out and they were still using Snyderverse characters, and they were all these stories about Wonder Woman continuing on in the new DCU, and so it got very confusing. But the one thing, and we're going to dive into that, because somebody's not telling the truth. That's all I'm going to say. Somebody's not telling the truth. But they did say something when they first announced this new formation of the DCU, that because of the success of Joker and because of the success of the Batman, Robert Pattinson's, that they were going to continue those movies, and how they were going to do it is anything outside of their DCU would be considered Elseworld. Elseworld movies. And now, if you're a comic book fan, you know exactly what that is. DC does that. They have these Elseworld stories, which is kind of like Marvel's What If. They take place outside of the actual universe. So it's a whole different... I like that idea. I think as long as it's clearly marked at the front of the film, Elseworld, and you know this is not a DCU movie, I don't think there's going to be any confusion. I think that's going to be able to be okay. And the reason I'm saying that is because I was a fan of Joker, although I no fucking way, shape, or form ever going to be a fan of the second one, because a fucking music, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Makes no sense. And I'm also a huge fan of Pattinson's Batman. I thought that was really well done, and it can exist outside in its own little Elseworld. And the reason I'm bringing all that up is because I think that Gunn and Safran are making a huge mistake by getting rid of Michael Keaton. I think it's a horrible idea. The overwhelming success of Keaton's return is the only reason that Flash made any fucking money at all. everybody wanted to see Keaton's return as Batman, and all of the critics overwhelmingly agreed that it was epic and the best part of the movie. You have a real opportunity to keep him in the Elseworlds films,
yeah,
right? And where I'm saying I think you should go, and I know you're going to agree with me, and I can't wait to hear your opinion on this, there is a huge opportunity for massive money-making franchise with Keaton, Batman Beyond. Mm-hmm. There is so much. People are desperately wanting a Batman Beyond film. And I get it. The older Keaton Batman can't function in the new DCU because they're clearly casting Batman. But he can be an Elseworld movie. And I think his older version of Bruce Wayne, and then let's cast a Terry McGinnis. Let's get that Batman Beyond going and set it in its own Elseworld. I think it's a huge opportunity for Warner Brothers, and I think they're making a huge mistake by not capitalizing on it.
Yeah, I think, you know, since we've been talking about this, ever since the Batgirl movie got shut down, and even before that, we were talking about wanting a Batman Beyond film, but now it's becoming more pop culture. Everybody was thinking the same thing. They want that type of... I mean, we haven't seen a live-action role where Batman isn't Batman, where Bruce Wayne isn't Batman.
Right.
You know, we need somebody else to take over that mantle.
Yeah.
Because now we are in the superhero genre, not just DC, but also Marvel. We are experimenting with other characters playing that superhero. Of course, we have Sam as Falcon and a couple of other ones, of course, like we talked about Ant-Man and now Blue Beetle. But I mean, they have this perfect opportunity to do that, and especially to get more into the business side of things. When Michael Keaton signed on, he signed on for quite a bit of projects.
10.
10 projects.
Yeah.
So how is that going to be fulfilled? Is it going to be a payout? Or can y'all get your heads out of your asses and use this concept and finally bring it to life? Because I feel like a lot of people are in need of this right now, especially with you bringing in these newer characters.
Yeah.
Why not just bring in a familiar superhero, but also a new character at the same time to a lot of the people who obviously didn't watch the animated show. But yeah, I just feel like that would be a great opportunity to jump on. I think once they see, hopefully, once they see how successful the Superman movie is going to do, maybe then they'll start taking more chances about further down the line on how to expand these different universes. Because I also want to see, like we've talked about before as well, a Bat family. I want to see Red Hood and fucking on the big screen kicking ass. Like, I just feel like, and Nightwing, like, it would just be absolutely amazing. So there's a whole bunch of different opportunities here, but I do think they are a little scared to step too outside the box because of DCU or just DC's history in the past.
Right. Well, I am a Batman, the animated series guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was my, like, youth, and my, your generation was Batman Beyond. And mm-hmm. I think a live action version of this, you're going to get all of the Keaton people. You're going to get all those people. And those, the Keaton people are the Batman, the animated series people, because that was based on Keaton's Batman. So, I mean, Danny Elfman did the theme. It was dark in nature, just like, so you're going to get all those people. And then you'll be able to cross that generational gap and get your generation with the Terry McGinnis people and the Batman Beyond people. It's a huge opportunity to satisfy both groups, which would mean big money. And I, by the way, from everything that I've heard or read, Keaton got paid up front for all 10. So whether, if they don't even use him, he got paid. It was a pay or play deal, and he got it all up front. So I don't know. I mean, good for him. Good for him. Yeah,
they're talking about saving money, but then you go and do that and you can't a couple of the films. Like, it just, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
But I feel like you have a lot of opportunity in that world to do that type of thing. And I just feel like, you know, and I, what, Was it just me, or did the there was a general in Blue Beetle that I thought was the alien guy that they teased in Snyder Cut, Martian
Manhunter?
Yeah. I felt like, you know, if they were going the same route as that, I don't know if they were trying to imply that guy, because I felt like they stayed on him a little long, but I don't know. So it was just, you know, I feel like these all these different characters that haven't seen the light of day in live action form that you have opportunities with.
Oh, without doubt. And like when you were saying the Bat Family, that's not going to happen in Batman Beyond, because Batman Beyond is well past that. Well, it's set that, in the future. But there may be, I'm hoping that this latest report means that this is true. There was a Nightwing film in development that just got shelved. It's canceled. It's dead on arrival, not happening. Now, is that because Gunn and Safran plan on using Nightwing? Are they going to like launch him themselves, and that's why they scrapped the old project and not going to move forward with it? And are they going to recast Batgirl, or are they going to bring her back and somehow work her in? Because I'm with you. The Bat Family is extremely popular. And remember, Gunn is a fan of Titans. And Titans did a really good job of the Bat Family, bringing in Jason Todd and bringing in Tim Drake and bringing in, you know, Dick as Nightwing and even Batgirl. So as Oracle, it was her past her Batgirl days. But they did a good job with that. And the popularity of that show, I think, shows you that that could work in a live-action universe, right? So the question is, we know that we're introducing Batman with Robin, right? It's going to be Batman and Robin, and it's Damian. It's Damian Wayne. So that would imply that he's a bit older than what they're claiming Superman is going to be, because that would mean that Dick is already Nightwing, and they've already gone through Jason and Tim. So, because if you're getting to Damian, then if they're going to stick with comic book accuracy, Jason and Tim would have already been Robin by the time we get to Damian. So how old is Batman going to be at this point? And where is Nightwing? And it's going to be. And so let's use that as the transition into, because this is the other thing that people are consistently saying doesn't make sense. They thought that James Gunn said that it was going to be a young Superman movie, and that they were getting rid of Cavill because they were casting younger. And then, of course, when Cornsweat came out as the choice, he's only like a year or two younger than Cavill. So it wasn't any kind. And now Gunn is trying to clarify that he never said he was making a younger Superman movie, that it wasn't a young Superman movie. What does that mean? I don't. He's early on in his career. He has said that, so he's early on in the career, but not necessarily a younger person. So, is that implying that he got started later? So it's so much confusing stuff. So let's talk about the casting, because I feel like that caused a lot of back and forth. There are so many people that are like Christopher Reeve and only Christopher Reeve, Henry Cavill and only Henry Cavill, and it can't be anybody else, and we won't accept anybody else. And then you've got a whole faction of bring Tom Welling back as Superman from Smallville, right? And we're going to talk about that, because there's a whole bunch of people saying bring in the Arrowverse. They want Amell as Green Arrow. They want Gustin as the Flash. They want, you know, Benoist as Supergirl. But just staying away from that for just a minute, I personally, because everybody knows who's ever listened to this show, they know I'm a Christopher Reeve diehard. That is Superman. That's the one they all have to live up to. But I'm okay with Cornsweat as the new Superman. I think it's an interesting choice. He looks the part. I trust that Gunn says he's going to bring it back to what Christopher Reeve's Superman was, about truth, justice, the American way, and everything good, bright and happy, inspiration for the world, that's what Superman is supposed to be. And I believe this was a good choice to maybe try to carry forward the character in that way. What do you think? Are you happy about the casting? Do you think they should have stuck with Cavill? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, like we talked about on a previous show that we did when they did the casting announcement, more reporting on it, I was very, you know, okay with it, because like I've said before, Superman isn't necessarily my favorite character, so I'm always looking for somebody to prove themselves to me. I do feel like just with his body build, I like that more. I want more of a tone, not like a big husky muscular like Cavill was. I feel like Cavill was just too big for the role.
Right.
I don't know why they made him go like crazy. I guess, I mean, the animated series did like make Superman huge and all the animated cartoons and stuff like that. But I prefer like just an average guy that is toned and muscular, but then has these abilities to help someone. He's supposed to be kind of like Spider-Man, where he can fit in with the world, do whatever he does. He's actually really a nerd and really goofy, but then also is a super badass that can save the world anytime he wants to. So I was happy with this choice, just because, I mean, seeing his performance in Hollywood on Netflix, he played that role really well, and I had never seen him before. So to see him, you know, bring such a dynamic complexity to the character that he played in that series, I felt like really proved himself to me, to where I feel like he can also bring that same complexity to Superman and make him more relatable, make him more down to earth. Like the guy who plays Superman and Superman and Lois, I love his build. I feel like that's exactly what Superman should look like. Yeah. You know, I mean, of course he's shredded and muscular, but he's not like over the top bodybuilder.
Yeah.
I felt like that was just a little too much, but I'm super excited about that. And then, I mean, I know you were a little hesitant at first, but then you came around because you're excited to see what Gunn's going to do. But I mean, I think we're both in agreement from the get go that we're really excited about Rachel Brosnan being Lois Lane. I feel like nobody had a complaint about that at all.
No.
So I think she's going to just knock it out of the park. And I feel like the both of them together, if they can nail that chemistry, I think it's going to be a great film.
That's the thing. It's all about the chemistry, right? So, and I'm glad that you brought up the Superman and Lois, because Tyler and Bitsy, they nail the chemistry. They are like the spot on best versions, in my opinion. And I've said this, I still think that Christopher Reeve is hands down the single best Superman ever. But the single best Superman and Lois, and the combination of, easily, hands down, Tyler and Bitsy. I think that they nail the characters perfectly. And I'm in agreement with you. In order for Superman to look like Cavill, he would have to be bench-pressing buildings. Like, the whole point of his super strength is because of the yellow sun, and because of what it does to his body, it makes him more dense and makes him more, it has nothing to do with it bulks him up. It's not like Hulk or something like that. So he would just be a normal size guy that happens to have this infinite strength. And in order to build his muscles, he would have to be just doing insanely ridiculous stuff to get the size Cavill was, right?
Yeah.
So, and then my next question is going to be, and I'm torn between this, because like I said, Christopher Reeve was my guy, and I think what he did brilliantly, and I don't think it will ever be matched, is the Clark Kent Superman transformation. But Tyler plays the what we're more used to now, where he's not a nerd, he's not a dork, he's just a normal, nice guy, right? And it works. I'm okay with his version of Clark Kent. Right? So I'm really curious to see which direction Gunn is going to go with it. Is he going to be the nerdy guy that tries to be over the top nerdy so that nobody suspects him? Or is he just going to be the normal guy that just blends in but isn't a geek or isn't a nerd or doesn't stumble and trip? And like, you know, I'm torn, because I love both. I love what Christopher Reeve did, and that transformation. Just the simple, you take off the glasses and stand up straight, and he looks like a completely fucking different person, and all he did was stand up straight. I mean, that's incredible. That is like to be able to pull that off with just that simple move is unreal. And I agree with you. I think that's why David is going to be amazing. It's David Cornswain, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's going to be great because Christopher Reeve was a Juilliard-trained actor. I think people don't realize that. That's why something as simple as standing up straight drastically changed the character. This guy's Juilliard-trained. And what we saw, I agree with you, from Cornswain in Hollywood, this guy's got the chops. I think he can he can pull that off. So I think he's going to be capable in either direction that Gunn goes. Do you want him to be that nerdy guy that manifests into Superman, or do you just want him to be the guy that blends in that becomes Superman? I don't know which one it's going to be, but I think that that he'll be able to pull it off in either direction. But just to kind of wrap this little thing up, I agree with you. I think the chemistry has to be there. I love Rachel. She's phenomenal, and there's no denying she's a brilliant talent. And we know, as we just said, that David's got all the chops. But do they work together? And according to Gunn and John Papsidera, they do. They were very specific. What did we report when we were talking about it on the show a few weeks? They tested six people, three men and three women, and they were crossing them over and over. You toe with this one? Okay, now you do with this one? Okay, now you do. Trying to find that chemistry. And so I feel like the effort that they put into it and the cross-auditioning and the cross-reading, and all, I think they feel comfortable that they found that chemistry. So we'll see.
Yeah, I agree. And something that it was the talk of the town over the past month. I feel like everybody was just trying to get to the bottom of it. And we're talking about the Gal Gadot situation with James Gunn and Peter Safran. I think, you know, in my opinion, we even reported on it and then had to take it out of the show because it was just hearsay. But in my opinion, I feel like in the early negotiations with Gunn and Safran, they had a conversation with Gal and were talking about the possibilities of bringing her back and having her develop a third Wonder Woman with them. And that conversation happened. But then once they finalized their agreement with Warner Brothers Discovery, they started to map out their DCU. They started to map out their 10-year plan. And then they realized they wanted to shed light on new characters. So I think that may be where the confusion is, because we know how this industry works. You have a conversation with somebody and it doesn't matter how long time has passed. You feel like that conversation still holds true, but a lot of stuff can happen in between that conversation to where we are now today. So I feel like they didn't want to backpedal on Gal's proposition or Gal's, you know, ideas and things like that. But then they just came to grips and realized that they needed to build something on their own. That's what I believed happened. What about you?
I do believe that I believe that Gal Gadot is telling the truth. I believe that that conversation did happen, and I believe it was word for word what she said happened. That they said, "You don't worry about it. We love you as Wonder Woman. We're definitely going to develop a film with you. The future looks bright." I believe that conversation happened, because if you remember, Momoa also came out along those similar lines and said that they were really happy with Aquaman and that there was a huge future for him in the DCU. And then all of a sudden now they're kind of like, well, but he might not be Aquaman. He might be somebody else. And then now they're saying, oh, no, he's not going to be anybody else. And so now we don't even know if he's going to be Aquaman or not. But remember when he had that, he came out and was great meeting at Warner Brothers today and they've assured me this, they that, but you know. So I think they had those conversations with a few of the people. And I think, because in my reasoning is like, what does Gal Gadot have to gain by lying about it? Like coming out and saying that there's no gain from that. She's not getting anything by coming out and making up a story like that. So there's no reason for her to do that, which is why I think she's telling the truth. And I think that what you said is most likely what happened, but so why, and I'm a huge fan of Gunn, but I don't understand why you come out and try to discredit Gal, saying, right, oh, that's not how the conversation happened. That's not what we said. Just say it is what you said, and then say that things changed, and now that we realize this and that, and kind of, but we hope to work with Gal somehow, some way, and maybe this or that or whatever. But don't try to discount that what she's saying is a lie, because you know, to me, it's okay to say, yes, we had those conversations, but we've kind of decided that we want to move in a different direction, you know, kind of a thing. It's okay to say that. Don't to come out and try to deny that you ever said it and say that she's basically now without saying she's a liar. He's basically saying right. she's lying. And I didn't get the point of that. I'm just like, you're in a position to just say we had a conversation and we decided to go in a different direction. And we feel, you know, that's okay. So and then, of course, Safran kind of did the same thing with Shazam, because remember, Peter Safran was the producer on both the Shazam movies, and they at the beginning of this whole thing sure sounded like they were hinting that his Shazam would be a part of the DCU, and now they seem to be backing off of that really quickly as well. So it's like, what the hell is going on? Are you recasting everybody, or do you plan on? My personal opinion, I think you have to recast everybody.
I think so too.
I think if you're rebooting the universe and you're trying a clean slate and you're trying to start over, you have to recast everybody. Now, if you want to keep Godot, do an Elseworld movie. That's a Wonder Woman in an Elseworld story. That's fine. Do that. And you've already established that these would be separate universes. So people are good with that. They understand that. So, but I don't think it's a wise idea if you're calling it a full-on reboot, a full-on start over, let's clean the slate, to keep anybody from the past. I just don't think that's a good idea. Now, that said, I like all these like people coming out and saying, let's put Gustin in as Flash. Let's put Amell in as Arrow. Those guys nailed those fucking roles. Like, I mean, Gustin was spot on Flash. Like, he just got it. He understood the character. He nailed it. And Amell, tell me this, just from what we've been seeing with Stephen Amell on Heels, right? We're starting to see those acting chops. He's starting to show some range there and starting to show some stuff. Wouldn't you like to see Amell back as Arrow and go into the alcoholic storyline where he starts to go down the drain as an alcoholic and starts to lose his shit and starts to get fucked up? I mean, I think a lot of people that aren't comic book fans don't realize that he had a very similar story to Iron Man, where he was on top of the world and then he started this spiral downfall, gets addicted to alcohol, becomes an alcoholic, and just has, you know, he gets kicked out of being the mayor and just like I would love to see him pull off that storyline. I think he would be phenomenal at it. And then again, are we going to go that route? Do we see Speedy? And if we see Speedy, are we going to show that he's a drug addict? Right. Are we going to, because wait, we've got Green Arrow as an alcoholic and his ward is a drug addict. Are we going there, or are we keeping it all lovey-dory, happy, fresh, inspiring? Because remember, that was a big complaint from a lot of people towards the Snyderverse, is that it was too dark. It was too heavy. That's not DC. They're more uplifting and lighthearted. So where are we going to go with these characters? Because I feel like the Arrowverse, while it had comedy and some lightheartedness, it was dark. It was built on a dark kind of a section of that. So would we see that? I don't even know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I feel like, you know, they did what they did. Let's just put it that way, for the Arrowverse and for the CW. And it was all amazing. Let's be honest about it. What Greg Berlanti did was phenomenal, starting this whole universe and even being better than the movies, because you always hear about how movies are supposed to be better than TV shows, but in this case TV shows were better than the movies. But in my opinion, I think you just need to hand the torch off. I think, you know, it's time. I think, you know, like we talked about, rebooting is just recasting. So in different stories, getting into different things. So I think it's time for just all of those actors to walk away from it. I really loved them in those roles, but I would much prefer just to recast, in my opinion.
Do you think, though, because Berlanti clearly showed that he had an understanding of the characters, because they were very comic book accurate. Mm-hmm. Do you keep him on as a consultant? Do you bring him on and say, consult with our other people to make sure that they're going in the right direction with comic book we know Gunn is. Gunn gets the costumes right. He gets the characters right. He's always comic book accurate. But he's not going to direct every film. He's not going to write every film. So do you keep somebody like a Greg Berlanti on as a consultant to kind of guide along these other ones that are like, hey, you're veering off a little bit from who the accuracy of who this character is. Can we reel that back in a little bit? Because I feel like if you do recast everybody, don't use anybody from the Arrowverse or anything like that, but that you have a guy along with Gunn who understands the characters, who is a fan of the characters and keeps it on track for accuracy. Because again, going back to the Marvel thing, I think that's why Marvel worked so well early, is because it was so comic book accurate. The costumes were accurate. The origins were accurate. The powers were accurate. They took a little leeway here or there, but nothing so far off the beaten path that fans didn't like it. So I think that's necessary in this reboot for the DCU, is to keep it comic book accurate.
I think he should be DCU's Jon Favreau. I mean, just always be an executive producer, always be there on set, being able to give his two cents if it's needed, that type of thing. So I just feel like, you know, he would definitely be a great resource. Now, if he wants to do that, because he's been doing it for so long, that's the real question.
That's a good point, too. And then I'm really curious. I said step away from Superman, but I want to come back for a little bit. Are we going to see campy Lex Luthor? Or are we going to see businessman President Luthor? And because let me just say this. I hope that right out of the gate with Superman Legacy, we don't see Luthor at all. But although we've heard that they are trying to cast him. So I just don't think you need Luthor with Superman all the time. There's a great criminal rogue gallery there that they could pull from Brainiac and like Bizarro and like all these other kind of things. We don't have to necessarily see Luthor right out of the gate. But I think that it's more of a three-dimensional character with Luthor as the president, the businessman who becomes the president of the United States, who truly believes that Superman is a threat, because at some point he will turn on Earth and he's powerful enough to destroy Earth. So they have to stop him or keep him in check to make sure that doesn't happen. I think that's a much more three-dimensional version of the character than just a criminal mastermind who doesn't like Superman. Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
A president who feels that an alien invader is a potential threat to the planet seems legit. Right? You can get behind that guy, because I feel like a lot of people on Earth would get behind that guy, because what if he does snap and go nuts and we can't stop him, kind of a thing. So anyway, that's just my two cents on Luthor. I think that that is the way to go with Luthor, because it just makes more sense to me. It's a more interesting character.
Anything's better than Jesse Eisenberg. No.
And I hope also that we talked about this when we said characters on our top five a couple weeks ago, when we said characters that we think should have their own spinoffs or whatever. I hope that they dive deeper into Lois Lane's actual story and why she's the world-renowned famous reporter from the Daily Planet, and not just make her a side piece for Superman. I want her to be a strong woman character that's earned the Pulitzer Prize and is an investigative reporter and has been in dangerous situations with the mob or what. I want to see that, and I hope that we get that, and not just the, she's a reporter and she wrote a story about Superman and now she's famous. I want to see more of like who Lois actually is. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure, man. For sure. Well, I feel like we pretty much covered everything across the DCU right now that's being talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing else can really jump out at me, but I am excited for the future. That's the first time in a long time that I've said that about the DCU.
Yeah.
Or just in general for DC Universe. moviegoers, for comic book accuracy, for TV shows, all these different things. So it's weird. It's weird to feel this way.
No,
about
it is.
About superheroes that I felt like haven't been given their justice in quite a long time.
Well, and it's all going to come down to, and Gunn is well aware of it. Gunn is taking his time and he's trying to do it, like, because I think he understands that the entire DCU, the future of those characters on big screen, is going to rest on the success or failure of the new Superman movie. Does it launch the whole thing and it's massive, or does it kill it and they say they move on and don't try it anymore? That is going to be the deciding factor, is that movie. To just wrap it up really quick, one last thing. Do you think, because Gunn has already said that other heroes exist, they're already around, do you think that they should do what Marvel did and do a slow build? And we get a Justice League movie, or a Justice Society movie, or a Green Lantern Corps, or what? Or do they just, hey, they already exist, so now let's throw them in? I mean, where do you think the proper way to do that? I know we're going to see several of the characters in Superman, because they've already said that. So, yeah. But do you do it quick, or do you extend it out?
I don't know, man, because we have the best of both worlds, right? We saw the quick version with DC beforehand, rushing the Justice League movie.
Yeah.
But then we've seen the slow burn that was the MCU that led up to the Avengers. So that's a great question, and honestly one that I don't necessarily have an answer for you. I think it all depends on the leadership. But I mean, of course, people, fans, enthusiasts would love to see like the group movies sooner rather than later. But I also feel like there's something special about building up that storyline, especially when you've lost the fans' trust. So I think they're going to need to gain that back first before we rush into anything.
Especially, too, because you're going to be introducing characters. I mean, he's already announced a few characters that, unless you're a comic book fan, you have no fucking clue who they are.
No idea.
You need time to show those story arcs and develop those characters so that non-comic book fans can become attached to them. You can't just throw them into a group movie and go, you're just going to love them, right? That's what you have to build, that characters over time to get people invested in them. So I think that's why I think they should do it just a little. You can show that they exist, but don't just throw them all into some big, massive, epic movie without before giving them some character development and letting people see who they are. Right? I'm fine with a cameo here or there so that you know they exist in the world, but you know, I want to know more about them before you just give me like they're the star of the movie. What? Like, I don't even know who it is. So
exactly.
Yeah, so I'm hoping we kind of see that. That's we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, man.
We ain't gonna see shit until the strikes are over. Yeah. But you know, I'm like you. I'm excited about it. Fingers crossed, all in, that this Superman becomes what Christopher Reeve's and Richard Donner's Superman was for me. I hope it's that type of a superhero film that just launches something epic and that inspires young filmmakers and does all this kind of stuff. I'm hoping and praying that that's what we get and it launches everything. Otherwise, it's a crash and burn and we ain't getting shit.
That's for sure, man. For sure. Oh, my goodness. Well, now it's time for the top five segment, guys.
Yes.
I feel like, you know, the more we do these things, the more you get to know who we are. That's for sure. This week, the top five is top five actors or actresses for their most overlooked roles.
Yeah.
Now, this one is very interesting. Would you say so?
Oh, without doubt, because I feel like sometimes that you know, they hit one hit movie, and that's what you associate them with, right? And you forget that they had a whole career before that. Or they get one stinker. They get a bad bomb at the box office, and you forget that they had a whole career before that. And sometimes you just overlook something that might have been a hidden gem that like nobody knew about, kind of a thing. So I love this category, because I feel like I'm looking at our lists, and I think that, these are some lists of people, and people might not have ever seen these things or even heard of them. So it's going to be interesting.
That's the thing. I was trying to go back and like look for notable actors who I felt like people would be like, oh, they were in that? I'm yeah. Like, yeah, they actually played a pretty pivotal role in that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was very interesting. Starting out with my number five, we're going to Courtney Cox. And that one, when she was in Ace Ventura, Pet Detective with Jim Carrey.
Yes.
Not even a lot of people realized that she was in that film. Just because, I mean, when you think about Ace Ventura, you think about all of Jim Carrey's antics. You think about all of his goofiness. Probably him doing the best work he's ever done in his comedian role.
Right.
So it's something that I felt like, you know, not a lot of people remember that she was the potential love interest. I forget. I haven't seen that movie in so freaking long. But it's one of those that I feel like is the good, you know, her... what she does with the role, I feel like, brings a new light to the Ace Ventura character, because it kind of tries to get him back on track when this man is all super sporadic and crazy, right? But what she does is very pivotal, because it sets him a goal and gets him to the finish line. So I felt like that's a reason why she's on this list, because when people think about his films, the Ace Ventura films, they don't even realize that Courtney Cox was there.
Yeah.
So that's why I had to put her on my list. So number five for me, Courtney Cox in Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Good choice. My number five is Michael Keaton. And you're going, what? He has an underrated movie that nobody saw? But he does. Michael Keaton as Kenneth Feinberg in a film called Worth. Now, I know probably all of y'all right now going, I've never heard of it. What are you even talking about? What is Worth? So Kenneth Feinberg, if you're a political person, you know the name. And he's very famous for other things other than what he does in this. And I'm not going to touch that. We're not going to go there. We're going to talk about what Worth is about. So Kenneth Feinberg was brought on after 9/11 by the president as a special counsel, outside counsel, to determine... to take over and control, because it couldn't get done within the government. The government, it was either one way or the other. The community was thinking they were in favor or against, and they couldn't, they weren't the right people. So they brought in outside counsel, a special counsel, Kenneth Feinberg, to how do you put a worth on somebody's life that died in 9/11? Because this movie is all about when the government paid out to families money, basically survivor money, you know, hey, we're so sorry, here's money to take care of all of your expenses because you lost your breadwinner, you lost your... And so the problem is that how do you decide this family gets this much, this family gets this much, this family gets this much? And it came down to, well, who's to say that this person who did this job was worth any more than the person who did this job? And so it became Kenneth Feinberg's job to determine a person's worth and what their family deserved. You can imagine how hard that must have been to tell one family that their guy as a janitor didn't deserve to get as much as this guy as an executive, his family is going to get. And so his whole struggle and his whole journey through this was to figure out a way, a scale, something that would be determined by the American people to be fair. And so Michael Keaton pulls off this role brilliantly. It's probably one of the best acting jobs he has ever done. Like he captures everything about the struggle that I was just talking about that Kenneth Feinberg went through, what it did to his own family, what it did to him personally, trying to say that you're worth less of a human being that this guy was or that guy was. Keaton just captured it. Like you felt like he had been through it. Put it that way, like he was a part of this that in real life that actually happened. It was amazing. And this was just a movie that unfortunately kind of went under the weather. It was like I caught it on Netflix. I was like, oh yeah, I do kind of remember hearing about that, and then watched it and I'm like, holy shit, this is freaking phenomenal. So Michael Keaton as Kenneth Feinberg in a movie called Worth. You guys should totally check that one out. Yeah. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I've never even heard of it before.
Exactly.
So it worth it.
Aha.
But my next one, number four, goes to Jeremy Piven in Serendipity. If you guys didn't know, this is a John Cusack film where Jeremy Piven plays the best friend and is always just that supportive guy. He's very opposite of his character in Entourage, Ari Gold. But, I mean, it just shows his talent because not a lot of people know, but Jeremy Piven is also a big-time theater guy.
Yep.
Him and John Cusack are actually really close friends and came up together, I believe, in Chicago. And just the dynamic that they have in this film really portrays to a real-life brotherhood. So to be able to encourage someone to continue to chase after a love that may or may not be there, and, you know, because the premise is these two, a boy and a girl, a guy and a gal, they run into each other on an elevator, and they just have this amazing conversation, and they think it's love at first sight, but, I mean, who really believes that love at first sight, right? So basically events happen and years go by, further along we go, and, you know, things keep happening to where they keep reminding each other about the other one. So it's something that you feel like, is love real? Is love at first sight real? Is true love real? And I think that's what this movie portrays, and Jeremy Piven plays a great supporting role in supporting love. So that's why I had to put this one on the list. Such a great film. And I don't really know if a lot of people of my generation have seen it, because it came out in either the late 90s or early 2000s.
Yeah.
So if you haven't, be sure to check out Serendipity so you can check out all of the amazing cast of this film and Jeremy Piven, the man, the myth, the legend. We're always big fans of his. I'm sure you guys know by now by listening to the podcast. But yeah, just had to throw him on the list, man. Jeremy Piven at number four.
There you go. Nice choice. Nice choice. My number four, you've definitely heard of her, but I'm betting you have not heard of this film. Brie Larson as Grace Howard in Short Term 12. Yeah,
nope.
Wait for it, anybody? So, Short Term 12, basically, Grace and her boyfriend, they work at this facility that takes care of troubled children. And they're kind of like counselors for these troubled kids. And her boyfriend are dealing with these kids and all of their problems. And then this girl comes that kind of very much is going through some stuff that brings back some serious shit for Grace. And we kind of find out through the development of the movie that her life was really fucked up. And she was actually part of this whole facility kind of a thing. And it just, she starts to spiral. And it causes all kinds of problems. And it gets kind of like, but her performance there is just, it's top notch. It's like you think of her as Captain Marvel and you get, you know, all these things. But this is a very young Brie Larson who delivers a very powerful, dramatic performance in this role of trying to deal with taking care of troubled kids, who is also a troubled kid herself, trying to figure out adulthood, trying to figure out their relationship with the boyfriend, trying to figure out life. And it's a very powerful film. And her performance is phenomenal. And I just bring her up and she's my number four because I don't think a lot of people even have heard of the film or even like, so I think if you go back, it deals with some heavy subject matter and she deserves all the recognition because she's brilliant in the role. And I just think that because of nobody hearing the movie, probably nobody ever heard of her in this role. So it's definitely an underrated role and I highly recommend people go and watch it, especially for us with, you know, you guys know we do the mental health podcast now and, you know, we've been big into mental health and kind of talking about that stuff. This film deals heavily with those type issues and those type problems and she's just brilliant in it. So my number four, Brie Larson as Grace Howard in Short Term 12.
Nice. Love it, man. Love it. Number three, I felt like we were probably duking it out to try to get this one on our list, because this guy,
without doubt,
is just phenomenal. It was honestly one of the first ever things I had seen him in, because I didn't watch The Wire at all, but I want to go back and watch it because I've heard it's an amazing show. But we're talking about Michael B. Jordan, and in this show, Parenthood.
Yeah,
he was a very pivotal role in one of the daughters' lives, Hattie. But I mean, just the realism that he brought to the character, because he was playing a daughter's love interest, and just because he would talk about being a alcoholic and being a recovered alcoholic, and he was also, I forget if she was still in high school or not, or if they were dating, like where he was just like barely past the age of, you know,
still high school,
was comfortable.
Yep.
And he was kind of like an adult at a rec center or like a some sort of something where they cross paths. But just the amount of real life experience that he brought to the character, like, you know, to be able to learn from past traumas, to be able to learn from past mistakes, and to be able to help others because of the things that happened to you. So what he brought to that character was absolutely amazing and definitely worth the watch. Every time I get to that season on Parenthood, or those couple seasons on Parenthood where he's in there, they're always my favorite, because, I mean, he just blows it out of the park. He fits in with the family just fine. And yeah, man, Michael B. Jordan is definitely going to be a legend when it's all said and done. So number three for me, Michael B. Jordan in Parenthood.
Oh, without doubt, without doubt. And it's funny because I'm all caught up on everything, and even though I'm getting ready to start Ahsoka this weekend or whatever, but I thought about diving back in and watching Parenthood again. I've watched entire series like three times now, and it's just like amazing. So, and
so good.
Yeah, can you imagine? Because like you said, the character, it's just, he's being judged by the family for he's interracial. We should have mentioned the daughter's white. So they're worried about the interracial aspect. They're worried that he was a former alcoholic. They're worried that he's older, and he's the epitome. This character is the epitome of judging the book by the cover before you know the man. And they were immediately against the relationship before any kind of getting to know him kind of a thing. So yeah, he played that brilliantly. That's a great choice. That's a great choice. Speaking of Parenthood, someone that was the star of Parenthood and brilliant on that show as well, my number three, Lauren Graham. But I'm not talking about Parenthood. I'm talking about, if you're a woman, you've probably seen this. If you're a guy, probably not. Lauren Graham as Maggie in Because I Said So. It's Mandy Moore, Diane Keaton, Lauren Graham. It's phenomenal cast, okay? And it's basically about this relationship, this woman getting into a relationship, trying to figure it all out, becoming an adult, first big love kind of a thing. And Lauren Graham plays the older sister, Mandy Moore's older sister in this. Maggie. And what she just brings to the role is so much realism, right? Like, the whole time I'm watching it, I love her character because she's not in it a whole lot, but she's in it enough. And the moments that she's in it, it's exactly how I feel like a big sibling is. Just calling you out on your shit, putting you in your place, wants to be in your corner, but also the first one to smack you, you know, and Maggie is that, and Lauren Graham pulls it off brilliantly. I should just say, I think she's one, forget just underrated roles, she's one of the most underrated actresses in Hollywood. This woman should have an Oscar or an Emmy 10 times over for her shit, and the fact that she doesn't is just mind-blowing to me. And this movie and this small role in this movie is just yet another example of brilliant performance that somehow is not mentioned nearly enough. So if you get a chance, guys, I'm talking to you, because like I said, I feel like a vast majority of the women have probably seen it. It's a romantic comedy, but it's good. It's cute. It's worth the watch, guys, just for her performance alone, Mandy Moore's performance. And hey, you know that most streamed show in history now, like just killing ass, kicking ass on Netflix right now, Suits? You know Harvey Specter? An underrated role in this movie. He plays Mandy Moore's potential boyfriend, the one that all the kind of stuff. And he, Gabriel Mock, I'm talking about, brilliant. It should be an honorable mention because it's an underrated role for him. He's in this. So if you're a Suits fan and you love Harvey, check this thing out. I'm telling you, it's worth the movie. Number three, Lauren Graham, Because I Said So.
Oh, so good, man. So good. Number two for me is an oldie but a goodie, going back all the way to 1991. And I'm talking about Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
We're like, who was in Thelma and Louise? Oh, the one and only Brad Pitt. Yes, that guy, the man, the myth, the legend. He actually plays a very pivotal role in Gina Davis's storyline because she is in, let's just say, a bad relationship. I don't remember if it was abusive or not, but it's very bad, enough to where they don't actually love each other. So Susan Sarandon, Louise, and Gina Davis's Thelma, they go on a road trip to try to bring some new light into their life.
Right.
And Gina stumbles along Brad Pitt's character, who's just a young hustling, busting cowboy, just trying to make his way, figure life out. And they have a little hookup session, and it gives her enough confidence to realize that there's actually still love out there, and you can reinvent yourself at any point in time in your life. The only person that is stopping you is you.
That's right.
So I felt like he played a very pivotal role in, you know, boosting up confidence to give her that confidence to change things in her life. Well, until, you know, they drove off the side of a cliff. But
what?
You know,
spoiler.
If you haven't seen that by now. But yeah, man, I just, you know, it was one of those things where I talk about all the time doing my film study, going back and watching old films. And I had no idea Brad Pitt was in that thing. But then he popped up and I was like, no shit. That is absolutely hilarious. And you guys know Brad Pitt's one of my all time favorite actors. So I was very excited to see that. But yes, number two for me, Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise.
Well, there you go. That's funny. I mean, because I'm old enough to remember that when that movie was out and it was getting all the love, Susan and Gina were just nonstop talking about Brad and his performance and how pivotal he was. But you're right, it kind of just died off, and now it's not even talked about anymore, and nobody even kind of like realizes, you know. And I don't know if that's just a time thing or a testament to his career and how he just blew up and nobody even just remembers talking about that film, or like, you know. But yeah, that's a good choice. That's a really good choice. My number two is the late Robin Williams. Just miss this man every single day. Robin as Maxwell Wallace in August Rush, of which, by the way, a highly underrated film that I don't think nearly enough people saw. It's an absolutely brilliant film. Will bring you to tears, I guarantee you. But it's basically about a child prodigy musician who's orphaned and he's living on the streets. He's not really orphaned. His parents are trying to find him, have no idea who he is. He has no idea who the parents are, kind of a thing. But anyway, he's living on the streets and he's young, and he's playing for money, right? He's doing his thing, and he's kind of taken under the wing of another homeless musician that like takes a liking to him and kind of is keeping him safe and trying to make sure he's going to be all right. And that is Robin Williams' character, Maxwell Wallace. He takes August under his wing and is kind of like, hey man, I've been here my whole life, kind of a thing, on the streets. I got you. I'm going to take care of you, kind of a thing. But in the roundabout kind of a, he's hoping. It's that, I don't want you to be found. I don't want you to kind of, cause I want you, I have this relationship with you now, and I kind of want to be that guy for you, but also hoping like hell that this kid eventually finds his family and does. It's one of those performances like where you just feel for him. You don't want him to lose August, but then you kind of want him to lose August. And it's just, Terrence Howard is this guy. He's like this music teacher that's kind of like, whoa, this kid. And eventually the parents come across it. Carrie Russell from The Americans and now The Diplomat and all that, she's the mom. And I think it's Jonathan Rhys who is the dad. It's a phenomenal cast, and it's really, really good. But it's one of the lesser known roles for Robin Williams. Everybody, and by the way, in just in case you want to know how a bit older this is, August Rush, Freddie Highmore, old the good doctor. It was, he's a homeless kid. And he's literally a kid. This is long before, you know, The Good Doctor. But it's a great movie. And it's another one of those, like, I, in my opinion, award-worthy performances by Robin Williams that just fell under the wayside that nobody really paid attention to. And I wish more people had seen this film and had seen this performance. So go check out August Rush and Robin Williams.
Yes, so good, man, so good. A few things there, because August Rush, I don't know if I've even told you this, but that was a very big film in my childhood. Terrence Howard was the social worker who was looking for, yes, August when he ran away from the boys home.
Yeah.
And man, yeah.
Did I say music?
Yeah. The scene where, you know, because there was a point in period of time where August was away from Robin Williams's character, but then they come back in contact to try to, you know, make some more money off the street. But then, right, like, there's that negative tension to where, like, Robin Williams's character is like, no, you're going to be my shining star type thing.
Exactly.
And then the other kid busts the guitar over the back, and like, yeah, it was like, it's such a great movie that I feel like you said, that not a lot of people saw.
No, and you nailed it right there, because it was one of those roles from Robin where, like, he wants the kid, he wants to do right by the kid, but he also then wants what's right for him, and it's that dilemma back and forth, and it's yeah, just, you're rooting for him, and then you fucking hate him, and then you're rooting for him, kind of a thing. It's just, yeah, it was a very interesting a movie for me too in my life story, kind of. It's the last movie that I saw, because going to movies was a huge thing for me and my ex-wife. We used to go every weekend. It was a big, it's the last movie that we saw together. Yeah. So it holds a special little place for me also. So yeah, just check it out though. It's a really good, yes, movie.
Please do. Please do. Well, number one for me is a newer one, but not a lot of people talk about it, because I feel like it was due to the pandemic and, you know, everybody not really promoting stuff and just not getting necessarily this positive recognition, because there was rumors and controversies and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, number one for me goes to Justin Timberlake in Palmer. This is such a great movie. If you have not checked it out, please freaking do so. Like, literally crying the whole entire time. Basically, where it's a great representation of family is not always blood. You can basically adopt people when they come in and out of your life at such the strangest times, but at the right times. And it's something that is a testament to that. So I feel like, you know, it's one of those things where you feel the sense of camaraderie, you feel the sense of home. You get all of these things with a lot of social issues that are also attached to this film. It's a very much a conversation starter, and I feel that is why we love it so much. So yeah, if you guys haven't seen Palmer, it's on Apple TV Plus. So please check it out. Justin Timberlake, number one.
That makes me want to go watch it again. And we should throw out another honorable mention, because I think it's an extremely underrated performance of Alicia Wainwright. A brilliant performance by her, and not a lot of people talk about it. And so, yeah, it's definitely worth it. Justin is a great actor. He doesn't get nearly the recognition for his acting. I mean, you go back and you just watch The Trouble with the Curve, or I forget the name of the one that with Ben Affleck but like, he's really fucking great actor.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I could even see him legitimately moving behind the camera as a director, because you watch his videos that he's kind of like, you can tell this guy's a storyteller and like, yeah, that's an excellent choice for number one, because he doesn't get nearly enough credit for acting, I don't think. Speaking of, and I've talked about this numerous times, if you're a fan of the podcast, you know, this guy is the most underrated actor, I swear to God, and he just steals every fucking thing he's in, John Bernthal. Now, he's starting to get some recognition. He's starting to get talked about a bit more. I think Punisher had a huge amount to do with that with Daredevil. Maybe Walking Dead is Shane. But this guy can act his fucking ass off, and he steals every scene in everything he's in. There's a movie that came out a couple of years ago that, like, just went completely under the radar. I don't even know if a lot of people had heard. And I'll be honest, I'm a huge movie guy. I hadn't heard about this movie. A friend of mine was all pumped to see it, and that's how I found out about it. It's called Sweet Virginia, and John is the star of it. He's named Sam. The character is named Sam. He's an ex-bull rider, like a rodeo bull rider type thing. And he comes back to a town, and he befriends... This, we should say, this town is like all kinds of trouble now, all kinds of crime, all kinds of shady shit going down, kind of a thing. And he befriends a guy that is basically the guy behind all of the fucking trouble. He's basically like a mob guy, and he's behind all of it. And so it's Sam is trying to figure this relationship out. Like he genuinely cares about this friend and cares about this brother and is trying to, but he also knows that everything bad in his town, everything horrible happening that he's trying to fix and trying to adjust to and try to make better, this guy's responsible for. And the performance is just like, it's Bernthal at his best. It's such a range of up and down emotions that I feel like just, there's not a lot of male actors out there right now that can deliver the up and down range of emotions in one character the way that Bernthal can. You know, he can make you laugh, but then he can scare the shit out of you, and then he can make you cry, and then he's just got this range that you just, it's unreal. And sometimes he does it all in once. Like that dinner scene in The Bear season two, it's all there. You're laughing, you're fucking crying, you're scared shitless. You all in just one little scene, and he's that guy. And he does that throughout this entire film, Sweet Virginia. It's a total indie film. There's not a lot of huge names in it. It's kind of just one of those, like I said, that skipped under the radar that nobody really heard about. But I promise you, if you check this one out, you're going to mark it under your hidden gems film because it's that good. It's one you're like, how did I not know about this? How did I not see this? It's really fucking good. Since you're doing your dive into film history and films, kind of, this is definitely one from a filmmaking aspect, there's so much great stuff. And then his performance is just... And the fact that nobody's probably even fucking heard of this film, you know, it's just unreal to me. But my number one, Johnny Bernthal, is Sam in Sweet Virginia.
Oh, for sure, man, for sure. Another one that just sparked an honorable mention. There's so many honorable mentions.
I had a hard time just putting five, yeah.
Anthony Mackie in 8 Mile.
Oh, my.
Everybody remembers he was the bad guy, the anti-protagonist in 8 Mile. So funny, basically being the epitome of everything that you could have had, but you don't have talent type thing. So that, yeah, that's so freaking good. I don't know why that sparked in my brain.
No, but we could totally throw Marshall on there as well. Like, yeah. I don't think people realize, I get he was playing himself, but his performance is fucking epic. This is a guy with no acting experience whatsoever at all, just thrown into the role. And he's going up against Mackie. He's going up Kim Basinger. He's going up against all these like huge names. And he's fucking nailing that shit right out of the gate. I think he extremely underrated for that role. And in my opinion, I would love to see him do more acting. I think now that he's kind of stepped away a little bit from the music, kind of taking that break. I mean, he's here or there every now and then, but I would like to see him make a transition into that field. I think he would be fucking brilliant. He's a really good actor that I think, if given the right roles, could be huge.
I completely agree. I mean, there was rumors that he got approached to be the boxer in Southpaw, but then he didn't want to train for it. So then he said, oh, you should call Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah. I think if it's well, because he's that guy. I think he's always been that guy, right? It's like, if I want to do it, I'm going to fucking nail it, but I've got to want to do it, right? And exactly. So that's why I said it has to be the right roles to get him in there, but he's definitely a great actor, though. I'd love to see him and Timberlake in something together with Bernthal. Holy fuck, that would be like epic, man.
That would be
those epic guys, and throw in Jeffrey Dean Morgan in there and like just fuck that shit up.
It'd be crazy, man. It'd be crazy. But anyway, guys, we want to know, what is your favorites or top five actors and actresses most overlooked roles in film or television.
Yeah.
Please be sure to comment below in the YouTube section. Add us on Twitter at J Logan Austin at Crazy Ant CEO. We want to know, man. We love the fan interaction. So
we do.
It's always a good time.
We do.
Now heading over to the box office recap. Like we said, Blue Beetle rocking yes. and rolling. Not necessarily the best start, but it definitely, hopefully good word of mouth keeps it going for a little bit. But it did dethrone Barbie at the number one spot. It came in at number one with $25 million. Barbie did come in at number two with $21 million. Number three was Oppenheimer, still doing very well. And number four was Teenage Ninja Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem with yes. $8.5 million. And number five was Strays with $8.2 million. That one looks funny. I want to go check that one out.
Oh yeah. Look, I'm gonna be honest with you though, because the $17 million from Oppenheimer and the $21 million, right? That's like $38 million. Those two movies aren't out. I think Blue Beetle hits $75 million opening. I really do.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that it opened against, you know, Barbenheimer, because that's like the big thing and it's still drawing people in. But I think Blue Beetle would have been good enough had it been released on a different date to come close to 100. I think it would have done at least somewhere in the range of $65 to $75 million. I really do.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree. And this week, new movies coming out. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Well, except Gran Turismo.
Yes.
And a Liam Neeson cell phone commercial redistribution. But that's all. Let's look forward to September in the meantime. But you went and saw this Gran Turismo movie.
Look, I'm going to tell all y'all out there listening and watching this, go see Gran Turismo, because it's freaking awesome. It's got to be one of the most intense movies I've ever seen. Like, the driving is fucking unreal. But what I really like about it is, if you're a gamer, okay, and the whole point of the movie is trying to mend the or mesh the worlds of gamers into real world. That was the whole point of this competition. This is a real life story about how this happened. And not only do they do it brilliantly in the storytelling, showing you how they took the hatred from the real racers towards the gamers, and like, you know, a gamer will never be on the podium. It's not going to happen. They called them the sim drivers. The way they did it, not only with the storytelling, but then the filmmaking aspect of it. There's this one brilliant scene where he is fucking like losing and he's got to like kick it into gear, and he's in this car and he's on the track and they're racing, and then all of a sudden the car breaks apart, like digitally breaks apart, and it's coming apart, and now he's back in his bedroom on the simulator and driving, and to it replicates, like, okay, I've done this 1,000 times in my bedroom on my simulator. Right. I know this track. I know that. And he starts to see that in front of him. And they continuously do that throughout, where you're like, you're seeing him revert to the gamer to get the realistic kind of a thing. And they don't shy away. There's like this crash. I don't want to give it away because I want people to see it, but there's this crash. And like, holy shit. I was like, oh fuck, like kind of it's a really intense movie. If you like gaming or you like racing or just like really good drama, you're gonna love this fucking film. I hope it does well, because it's really, and David Harbour, it might be my most favorite performance I've ever seen. He is brilliant in this film, and his chemistry with the lead guy, I hate that I don't know the lead guy's name, but they were brilliant together. They were really, really – Orlando Bloom, I feel, is like a token piece, bro. I'm not trying to be mean about it, but I just feel like we didn't even really need his character. Like, you know, I get that he was pivotal about making this competition happen or whatever, but I just feel like they either needed to develop that character more or just they didn't need him. But the dynamic between Harbour and the lead there, they're fucking brilliant together. And yeah, it's so good. And at the very end, they kind of show you the real guy. Mm-hmm. And they do these side by side, like the picture of the actor and then the real guy doing the things all together. You know, like when he was on the podium and the real guy was on the podium and all this kind of. It's really cool how they do that. And they make reference that the real guy is actually the stunt driver. He does all the driving in the movie. So, you know, he got. That's awesome. That's fucking awesome. But
yeah, that is really cool. Archie. Madkwe.
Well, so let me tell you something. That guy is fucking brilliant. He does an amazing job. You really feel for his character. And is it Dimyun Haju that plays the dad? I can never say that man's name.
Yes.
Yeah. He, too, the dynamic between him and the son is outstanding. It's a small role for him, but it's pivotal in the character development of the son. So I know I went way into this, but I want people to see it because it is really the only movie out right now, and I think that it's worthy of seeing. I was the only person in my theater, and it was on the big theater with like 300 fucking seats, and it was me.
Right.
So I want people to go see this movie. Like, you don't just have to go see Barbenheimer. God damn it. There's other movies. Go see this movie.
Yes, please do. Please do. Because, yeah, movies you can still go see. Meg 2, The Trench, Talk to Me, Haunted Mansion, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Sound of Freedom. Now heading over to the IMDb Pro's top trending segment, Oppenheimer is still raining high, or exploding high, I should say, at the top of the movie streaming.
Yes.
Only Murders in the Building is the top trending TV show right now. Loving season 3. It's phenomenal so far, and the dynamic between Paul Rudd and Steve Martin is hilarious.
Oh, I can only imagine. I haven't jumped on it yet, but yeah, I can only imagine.
And the top trending star is Gal Gadot. I'm guessing because of all the rumors back and forth
and with the Netflix movie. She's got a new Netflix spy movie, and I'm gonna be honest with you. You guys know I'm a huge Gal fan. I think she's brilliant. I think she's a great actress, and she's beautiful, and she's all. I couldn't get through the movie. I couldn't. I tried. It's got some good action shit. She's kicking ass, but I just the storyline. I turned it off. I'm just gonna be honest. I gotta call it like it is. I couldn't get through it.
Yeah, a show you should watch. It's on Apple TV Plus with Idris Elba, Hijack. It was so good. We binged watched 7 episodes in like 3 days.
Okay.
So yeah, you should definitely check it out.
All right, and then,
it's really freaking good.
I'm gonna tell you, I watched, and remember we talked about this on the show numerous times when we were talking about the casting and all that. I checked out Plane with Gerard Butler and Mike Coulter. It's actually really good. It's a really good movie. I was like, oh, okay, I forgot all about this one. Let me check it out. And yeah, it was fucking it. It's a Gerard Butler film, but you know, but him and Mike Coulter played really well together. And it's actually a really interesting story. And they clearly, like we had talked about on the show, they set up Mike Coulter's character going off into a sequel and kind of doing it. So check that one out when you get a chance. I think you guys will like it.
Oh, for sure, man. For sure. Well, we got to thank everybody for getting crazy with us on episode 232. Oh, my goodness. Everybody knows they can follow us on social media, the company at Crazy Ant Media, the podcast at ItCap Podcast, and our mental health podcast. Everything's OKP on Facebook or on Instagram and Twitter, and you can follow us on Facebook under Crazy Ant Media as well. And you guys know you can follow us both personally on social media, myself at J Logan Austin and
at Crazy Ant CEO.
That's right. And you guys know you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere you listen to your podcast: Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Stitcher, and so much more. If you're watching this video on YouTube, we appreciate you. Be sure to leave a like, be sure to comment below, and subscribe to the channel to stay up to date with all the latest and greatest things happening here at Crazy Ant Media. And you also have to be sure to visit our website, www.crazyantmedia.com, where you can start rocking the latest and greatest Crazy Ant Media gear, keep up to date with our projects, and so much more. We're super excited about everything, and I mean, I'm just super excited about the future of the DCU. I mean, like we talked about, there's a lot of things on the horizon that are actually... I'm optimistic about, so it's going to be very exciting to see how they're all executed.
Oh, without doubt. I, like I said, I just for me, it's forever going to be that 1978 Christopher Reeve Superman. It inspired everything that I've ever done as a filmmaker or in the industry or my art, drawing. It's that thing. And I have the highest of hopes for this new Superman and James Gunn that he can recapture that magic and get us back on the right track of that. I'm optimistic after seeing Blue Beetle. I don't want to get too excited, but it was good. I did enjoy it. So I'm hoping. I'm really, really hoping. I'm excited about it. And I'm also really hoping that we can get these fucking strikes over so we can get back to doing what we love. It's yes. driving me insane, and I would just want to get back on a film set myself and be able to do what we do and start to get rocking and rolling. And along those lines, though, I just want to quickly say huge thank you to all of you out there, all of our listeners and our viewers who are still tuning in every week and still leaving all the comments and following us and everything. Because an entertainment podcast where we talk about all this kind of stuff, but really nothing's going on except for the strikes, and we can't talk to guests because they're not allowed to come on the show, kind of. And you guys are still tuning in. You're still hanging in there with us. You're checking out the mental health podcast, and you're jumping over there, and you're kind of. And I just really wanted to say thank you. And we really appreciate you guys hanging in there and going through the whole thing with us and just staying loyal, because it's a tricky time right now, and it's kind of like bouncing all over the place kind of a thing. And so we really appreciate you guys and everything that y'all are doing and the support and the comments and just hanging with us. And definitely beyond just this one, listen to the Everything's Okay podcast, guys. We've had some just lately phenomenal. Lauren Bugioli and Dave Frank and the Yoniverse women, and just we have had some really great conversations over the last month or so, guys. On all different topics, ranging on all different topics, and you will be educated, and you will feel, and you'll relate, and you'll just. It's a really good thing, and it's helped us a lot. I can just speak because of all the stuff going on with the strikes and us not being able to do what we normally do, being on the set, doing the film stuff, doing the television stuff, that, you know, that's mentally challenging. And so to be able to have that release and that escape on our other podcast and to be able to talk about things and have that outlet, it's been amazing. So just thank you, everybody, for like tuning into all of them. It's amazing.
Yes, it absolutely is. And Crazy Ant Media is also offering a new thing here at the company.
True.
And that is podcast consulting. If you are a creator or someone who just feels like they have something to say, we will help you start a podcast. Yes, that's right. Be sure to email us at info@crazyantmedia.com. For all the details, we can set up a consultation and just try to navigate what's going on in your brain, what are you thinking about, and how to execute this and to get your voice out there. That's what we're all about, man, lending that helping hand to help everybody start their own thing and be their own boss. I think that's very important.
Yeah.
But, I mean, speaking of their own bosses, everybody knows we love the one, the only,
Oprah!